welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, September 1st, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host. Perhaps some of you are now recovering from that new escape from reality show called the Republican National Convention, where they spent 4 days and nights trying to convince you that Mitt Romney's really a nice guy. I don't really care if he's a nice guy. I wish he had some competence and that he wasn't pursuing the same kind of fascist policies as Obama. But if you are watching this, you're probably now preparing for the next segment of the escape from reality show called the Democratic National Convention. If so, I hope you have antacids and Tums and things of that sort. But I would recommend don't watch it and get active, because it's time for you to tune into reality. And that's what we're going to be dealing with today. The reality that our nation is heading into self-destruction at an accelerating rate. And there are two candidates for president, if Obama is renominated, who are presenting policies and postures which will hasten the collapse and lead to a potential for a thermonuclear war. Before I introduce our guest today, I want to call your attention to two courageous acts which must be repeated often if we're going to escape this crisis. And when I say courageous acts, I mean people who put themselves on the line for the nation. Actually, I should say there are three, but the first two, one is a letter from a union leader named Gregory Lance from Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, as you know, the unions are generally taken for granted by the Democratic Party. And Lance is a member of the Machinists Union, the International Association of Machinists. And in his letter, he said, President Obama must step down. He must not be renominated. And this is, for him, it's the most outspoken. He's a union official in Charlotte. But it's the most outspoken on this importance of removing Obama. I mean, it's one thing for the unions not to show up in Charlotte, one thing for them to say they're not going to give money. It's another thing for them to come out and say Obama must be removed. Now, secondly, there's a letter from U.S. Representative Walter Jones, a Republican from North Carolina. Some of you may remember about 3 months ago or so, maybe it was even 4 months ago, he was on the program where he talked about his bill, HCR 107. Which says that it reaffirms the constitutional principle that the president cannot carry out offensive military action without going to the Congress. That's in the Constitution. That's in the War Powers Act. And what Walter Jones did this week is send out a letter to President Obama stating that directly, that he must not carry out action either in Syria or against Iran, without first going to the Congress. And the letter to Obama said, if you do so, you will set yourself up for impeachment by violating the U.S. Constitution. Now, the third example is from Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Dempsey. In London, Dempsey gave an interview where he ridiculed the stupidity of the idea of going into Syria. He basically said, if you set up a no-fly zone or a zone in Syria to protect refugees, you're going to have to deal with anti-aircraft, you're going to have to deal with missiles. It's not the same as Libya, and no one should assume it's the same of Libya as Libya. And he also reiterated his statement that there's no legitimate reason for Israel to launch a strike against Iran, that to do so is inviting a bigger war. And this is the man who's in charge of the U.S. military. Now compare that to Obama, who's preparing for a U.S. invasion or a U.S. escalation with Syria and with Iran, or Mitt Romney, who says that Obama is too soft on these situations. In fact, Romney said Obama is too soft on Russia. These guys can get you all killed. And so I point to these three examples of courage. Gregory Lance, International Association of Machinists local leader, Walter Jones, a U.S. congressman, and General Dempsey, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We need more of those kinds of statements before Monday and Tuesday coming from leading members of the Democratic Party to get Obama out. Now, joining me to discuss this on the program today will be two people who are familiar to you. And by the way, let me just add, those letters are, those statements from Jones and Lance are available on the LaRouche PAC website, so you can read the statements that they issued. So joining me today will be Rachel Brown, who is a candidate for Congress in Massachusetts. She has a primary election next Thursday, and she's running unopposed. Well, not really. She's got two opponents, but you add them up together and they come up to a big zero. Rachel is known from her campaign against Barney Frank. I'm convinced that she's the reason Barney retired, went off and got married to his longtime boyfriend, and unfortunately, he's still opening his fat yap. So we haven't completely had him silenced yet, but Rachel, I'm sure, drove him out of politics. So we have Rachel Brown on the program, and also Keisha Rogers, who won her Democratic primary for the second time in a row in the 22nd District of Texas. She is the Democratic nominee for Congress, and she ran on a program which said Obama must go. So Rachel and Keisha, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, Rachel, let's start with you, because you have had a series of debates, you've got some very high-profile organizing going, and you've put out several statements recently, including a statement that reiterated what Mr. LaRouche has been saying, which is that if Obama is not removed, we could be in a situation of nuclear war. You brought this up at the debates, you've brought it up in every event you've done. What kind of response are you getting to this? One of the points Mr. LaRouche has been making is the Americans are generally divorced from reality, and you need leadership to cause them to face reality. Are you finding that you can get people to face reality, and what are the reactions you're getting?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, that is pretty much one of the best ways to flank people thinking about the election, is to give them a sense of, this is a question of thermonuclear war. And we have found that even amongst Democrats, that for one, it does come down to a question of fear around Obama. And there are Democrats that are therefore, that are glad to see someone else that is a Democrat, but that's willing to say this, because a lot of Democrats are freaked out about the war, as they should be. So it is a real irony that Obama was supposedly the anti-war candidate, and now he's the one saying, let's get rid of the UN and invade Syria. So there is a lot of response on that from people.
Rachel, let me ask you, when you say there's fear, they fear Obama, do you think Democrats fear that Romney will be elected, or do they think they're going to be blacklisted if they speak against Obama? I mean, what do you think the fear is?
Yeah, I think it's all of those. It's definitely the fear of their neighbors, that they can't be seen not being a Democrat for Obama, because you can't be a Republican, so you have to be for Obama. I think some people are afraid inherently because of his Nero personality. They actually do have a sense that if this guy doesn't have support, he'll lose it, and so I think they're afraid for what that represents. And then definitely other people are afraid that they'll lose their social standing, or depending on what level of politics they're in, lose their career and even their life if they don't support him. So there's a lot of fear.
Do you think in the Massachusetts Democratic Party there's a lot of this fear? Because we have probably half the congressmen from Massachusetts, for example, have signed onto the 1489, the Glass-Steagall bill,
mm-hmm.
and a number of them are very strongly identified with progressive Democrats, anti-war, anti-police state measures. They were very vocal during the Bush-Cheney years. Why are we not seeing more coming out of the Massachusetts congressional delegation?
I think that's true. I think it is the fear. I was at an intervention with Congressman Markey shortly actually the day that Congress decided not to go on recess, and he said he agreed with the fact that the war question is serious and real and the hyperinflation is serious and real. We do have a meeting with another one of these anti-war congressmen from Massachusetts next Friday, so he actually does want to sit down with us and hear what we have to say, but I think it is fear. We also met with a Rhode Island political official yesterday who thought that it was the Congress's, the problem wasn't Obama, the problem was Congress. So
that's called stupidity.
Yes.
That's not fear. Now, one of your opponents in the race is Joe Kennedy III, the son of Robert Kennedy Jr., the grandson of Robert Kennedy, who was the Attorney General under John Kennedy and then was the front runner for president in 1968 when he was assassinated. And you had a very interesting exchange at that first debate when you brought Robert Kennedy to life. Why don't you describe that to our listeners?
Sure. I brought up this project, NOWAPA, which a lot of our listeners are aware of, and increasingly people throughout the population, but it's still sort of a not well-known thing. So I brought up this project, NOWAPA. People at this debate were asking me, is this a feasible project? What you're saying is interesting, but we're talking about budget cuts and cutting Social Security, and can what you're saying really be applied to these issues that are being discussed in Washington? And so I brought up the fact, letter from Senator Robert Kennedy, where he specifically cites NOWAPA and calls for cooperation with Canada in the investigation of it, and made the point with that this is feasible. We used to think about this. This was a program that was on the books being called for by Massachusetts senators.
So you quoted from the letter from Senator Kennedy. By the way, he was New York as a senator.
New York, right.
You read that in the debate. What was the response of Robert Kennedy's grandson to hearing that his grandfather had been a supporter of a policy that Lyndon LaRouche is the one who revived?
He was definitely very nervous because he obviously felt the pressure that he should know about this thing. He was a little bit, trumped, whatnot, you could say, by it. And I think it's good. I think he probably doesn't have the greatest advisors right now, but it is a question of, as we've seen with our push for Glass-Steagall, I think pushing things like NOWAPA to the foreground, I think we can do here.
And let me just come back to the war again. Earlier in the campaign, he put out a statement that pretty much dovetailed with the despicable senior senator from Massachusetts, John Kerry, has been saying, which is that the U.S. should go in and overthrow Assad. Has he backed away from that, or has he even talked about that? Or let me just ask you this. Has he even been visible during the campaign, Joe Kennedy III?
He has not been doing too many public forums. The two we did were, as far as I know, the only ones. There are, volunteers knocking on doors. His platform for the economy consists of stimulating the markets, calming the markets, so that they get money to small businesses, and that will create jobs. Which is obviously, so therefore he hasn't been aggressively attacking Iran or Syria. He's been trying to take a, unpublic approach on that, although I think he hasn't taken a stance against it. I think he would probably be a rubber stamp for Obama's war drive.
And Rachel, you put out a statement recently in which you said, you reiterated your insistence that Obama must go because of this war. You also went after Senator Kerry. What did you say in the statement?
Senator Kerry, I said, is a coward and treasonous because he definitely should know better. He fought in Vietnam, and he also fought against the Iran-Contra scandal. So he knows what corruption is. He knows what it looks like. And he's taking right now a complete 180-degree turn. He was actually speaking at a public meeting in Massachusetts a couple months ago, and it was reported in an article that he interrupted the meeting to take a call answering, "Yes, Your Majesty." Last year with the Libya war, he was the guy who allowed Obama to have some semblance of legality by putting out a resolution from his committee, the Foreign Relations Committee, saying, "Well, we support Obama in doing this." Although the Congress didn't vote on it, Kerry did his best to allow Obama to go in there, murder Gaddafi, and put us on this war path towards thermonuclear war. And now he's doing the same thing in Syria. Yeah. He just endorsed this Treasury Department license to provide weapons and money from Americans to the rebels in Syria to commit the what we're seeing as these atrocities.
You're listening to Rachel Brown, who is the candidate for Congress. Rachel, what district is it?
The 4th District.
That's right, the 4th District in Massachusetts. If you live in the 4th District or you know anyone who does, you should be making sure that people go and vote for Rachel. If you live anywhere near Boston, you should get online with LaRouche Pack after the show and tell them you're going to volunteer to campaign for Rachel between now and next Thursday, because this is a crucial indicator of the response in the population. And Rachel, if someone wants to see these debates that you had in the campaign, are they up on your website?
Yes, they are. There's links to all three.
And just give your website to people.
That's rachelforcongress.com.
That's pretty simple, rachelforcongress.com. And Rachel, stay on, because we'll be back to you in a minute. I want to bring in now your colleague on the LaRouche slate, Keisha Rogers. Keisha, how you doing?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Keisha.
Okay, ask your question again. I'm sorry, I got a little bit of brain fog here.
I just asked how you're doing.
I'm good.
You've probably heard what we've been discussing with Rachel. One of the things I'd like to come back to, because you've said a lot about this, is why is it that Democrats, some of whom are good and actually understand the danger of war, they're against the drones, they're against the NDAA, the indefinite detention without due process, they recognize that Obama is going with a completely crazy dictatorship and war policy, and yet they quietly go to the polls and vote for him. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think you guys have been discussing it. It's fear. And, you know, this is what I believe subjectively Rachel, myself, and the rest of the candidates on the slate really tried to tackle and are continuing to battle in the population every day that we're going out to organize people. I mean, I can tell you now I'm here at a labor event of the AFL-CIO, and you're still facing the fact that people are saying, is it that bad? Is it worth me putting my life on the line to go out and take on Obama? Do I really have to fight him? Do you know that this might mean I might get killed? I mean, that's the really reality that you're facing when you're actually going after a mass killer. And there can be no sugarcoating or rejection of that reality. That's what we're dealing with, and that's what people are having to come to terms with, or having to come to face. Are we going to have the guts to actually stand up to Obama? And I think what Mr. LaRouche just expressed in a recent discussion of what we have, our weekly reports every week, is that you're not going to find a majority of the people that actually have that courage and have the guts to stand up and say what needs to be said and actually act on principle to do what needs to be done in order to act in the interest of the nation. And that's what I've committed myself to. That's what my colleagues, Rachel, and the rest of the slate has committed themselves to actually do the things that are unpopular, that the population is too afraid to do. And I know that a lot of terms we use this term as in the expression of Franklin Roosevelt when he says you have nothing to fear but fear itself. And that's what we're up against right now. And I think that that's what we're battling with in the population. So people would rather compromise. People would rather say Mitt Romney and Ryan are worse. And so, therefore, we're not going to face the reality that there is no leadership with Obama, with Romney, or with any of the two parties, as I stated, that are representing the two parties of the apocalypse. And as long as people continue to bow down or to be victims of their fear, this can lead us into exactly what we've been warning for quite some time,
Keisha, let me cut you off. Let me cut you off there, because I want to pursue this a little bit, and I want to direct this to you, but also I'd like to hear Rachel answer it after you do. One of the things that we run up against with Democrats is they go berserk when they see the Hitler mustache that Obama has grown. Now, basically, we put it on him, but it's because he deserved it. One of the things I think, I'll throw this out to you for your thoughts, a lot of people have seen that that's what Obama is, but they're afraid to acknowledge it. And this is exactly what happened in Germany, where the Social Democrats, the Communists, and others knew that Hitler was crazy. They knew he was being supported by powerful interests. But they played this game, first Hitler, then us, that Hitler will be in for a little while and then we'll be able to get rid of him. But the real fear was not so much, there was fear, but it's also the fear that they were dealing with a killer. I mean, do you think that people actually are beginning to get the idea that Obama is this Nero figure that Lynn identified back in April 2009?
Absolutely. I mean, people know that everything that Obama has done, the outline of Obama's killer policies, the National Defense Authorization Act, the killing of American citizens with drones, the list goes on and on, the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, as we were discussing. People see this. They know it. I mean, they talk about it every day, and they actually say, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Or they are... they're submissive. They're submissive out of being petrified and fearful, because when you take away, as the population believes, the weapons of the population to be able to fight, and I think Mr. LaRouche actually had a beautiful way of actually expressing what's happened to the population, you know, why they're not fighting, why they see that, you know, you have a mass killer on your hands, but they are capitulating. Even in the United States right now, in a nation where, look, we have actually fought against the enemy. So I think it's absolutely true that, you know, people know what's going on, and they're refusing to fight. And they do recognize that, wait a minute, we are dealing with a Nero. We're dealing with a Hitler. And more people now are starting to come up to the mustache and actually express that, we were right. There's less freak out of the mustache than you had in previous times. You know, some people would just automatically, you know, kick you out. But at the same time, there are a lot of people that are, you know, still sticking to Obama and that are just outraged by the mustache. But on the other hand, a lot of people realize what we've done.
Let me pose this to Rachel from the following standpoint, because the last time we had a president who actually stood up to the establishment, really stood up to the establishment, was John Kennedy. And he demonstrated the kind of courage by his decision not to continue with the Vietnam War, and he paid for it with his life. Bobby Kennedy, the same thing, that Bobby Kennedy was moving in a direction that was a danger, and he was killed. Now, you look at the fact that people who know something about this war threat are being silent. To what extent, Rachel, do you think it is that people deep down know that we're right about Obama, but they're afraid to admit it? Or do you think there's also the other side of what Mr. LaRouche is saying is a willful stupidity of people who don't even want to think about reality? What do you think?
Well, certainly both, but definitely the Kennedy factor is very big. One thing I'd say is that as LaRouche has brought up a number of times, but I think the landing of this Curiosity rover on Mars, in one sense, is a part of that. Because it is in contrast right now to Obama's war drive, we're also getting a resurrection of the space program, and we just did something that mankind has never done before. So that and it was John Kennedy's program. So that's one sort of interesting character to the situation right now that you can sort of use to draw people out of that pessimism that was caused by the paradigm shift of the last 30 years and say, look, this other thing is what we have to get back.
Actually, you've got, with Kennedy, you've got both of them, because you have the idea of the big projects like NOAAPA plus the space program.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. And people recognize that is what they want. You know, I was on a radio show with a guy in Norfolk in the district, and he came out, he was a little bit, aggressive about, certain things about the campaign, the mustache, LaRouche, et cetera. But at the end, he was brought around in a certain way, and he, that was what he responded on too, was the question of NOAAPA. He brought that up himself. He said, so this NOAAPA project, I've heard some about that. Can you tell people about that? And he said, yes, our nation was built on big projects, and I agree with that.
And Rachel, are you also finding a resonance from the Mars Curiosity that goes beyond just being interested in the fact that we landed this thing nearly 200 million miles away from us, but people actually, some of the older people in particular, remembering the excitement about the space program? And also, we just had the unfortunate passing of Neil Armstrong, who was the first man to set foot on the moon. So certainly there is this element of the Kennedy era, the commitment, the idea of a mission. Are you getting some of that?
Yeah, definitely. When I've brought that up in speeches and things, again, people that were maybe a bit hostile at the beginning came up afterwards. Like one elderly man who, when I spoke at a Democratic meeting in Needham, first said, oh, I don't like LaRouche. And after I spoke and I brought up the SDI at the time, he came up and said, well, I worked on the SDI. That is great. What do you have to say about fusion? That kind of thing. And you also are getting it from young people, too. There is a response from young people. Did an interview with some reporters, and one of the young people, that young reporter, that was his question is, tell us more about this science question. And he actually stopped by the table later. A couple days later, he happened to drive by, and he came up and he said, he's reading about space right now, and he's just super interested that that's part of the platform.
Let me tell our listeners again that this is Rachel Brown you just heard from, and you don't have to live in the 4th District of Massachusetts to support her. You can go on her website from anywhere in the country and make a contribution. You can contact her campaign. It's rachelforcongress.com?
Yes.
rachelforcongress.com. There's less than a week, but we're going to be out every single day. It's Labor Day weekend. We're going to be hitting the streets, the kind of high visibility campaigns that we ran with Keisha Rogers, who won a second primary, the second time she's won the primary. Bill Roberts in Michigan got 41% of the vote. Dave Christie's vote in Washington State was lower because it was a totally screwed up primary where the voting is done by mail. But the fact is, Dave shaped that campaign, and then also we had Diane Sayre in New Jersey run a campaign that shaped the election there. So there's still time to do something to back Rachel. Now, you have until November 6th to back Keisha, because Keisha's campaign, she is the Democratic nominee, and maybe we'll talk about this very little man she's running against toward the end of the show. But Keisha, I want to come to you on this NASA question, because you made this the leading issue in the 2010 campaign when Obama was just beginning to slice apart NASA. and you made the issue Save NASA, Impeach Obama. Now, 2 years later, Obama has done incredible damage to NASA. He's cutting huge chunks out of the planetary missions that are supposed to be the follow-up to the Curiosity. At the same time, you have excitement in NASA, but there's been a great deal of pessimism that you've had to confront. Where do things stand now? To what extent has Curiosity emboldened people with NASA, or are you still running into this wait-and-see cynicism?
Well, I think some of both. I think you have found that Curiosity has actually restored a sense of dignity, a sense of emboldenment of the population, that they see that right now this mission and the landing of Curiosity on Mars with such a picture-perfect landing, and the fact that we did this despite Obama, as a real knockout to Obama, a kick in the face, that people feel that they have been empowered again. You know, I think that people recognize that what this Curiosity mission does is open up the doors for really taking off in the types of scientific endeavors that are needed for restoring a sense of a mission in the nation. But people are also not naive to the fact that, you know, Obama, after 1 week after Curiosity landed, when he felt like he had the time to call JPL up, Jet Propulsion Lab, and, you know, congratulate them, he made a mockery out of it. And, you know, we found that, as once again, from Obama, this was nothing but lies, because the senator from California had to go, Feinstein had to go to JPL and say, well, that was a nice speech Obama gave about protecting you all and being very proud of what you just accomplished, but I have to tell you, we're about to cut your budget again. And this was a total disgrace. And, you know, the budget cuts that we're seeing to the manned space program is what I adamantly fought against in my campaign for the full funding of NASA. But not just the full funding of NASA, that this was the science driver mission that is required to address the threats against mankind. And this is exactly what all of our platforms have been taken up. If you're going to deal with the galactic threats, the threats of solar flares, of asteroids, near-Earth objects that are bombarding the Earth right now, and you don't have a science driver, you don't have NASA, you don't have a space program with the legitimate instrumentation that can actually start to actually address the problems that are affecting the Earth by getting outside of the Earth, then you don't have a way to protect yourself or to defend the human species overall on this planet. And that's what we're actually dealing with right now. And that's what we're trying to get across to people, is that this Curiosity mission has to be looked at from the standpoint of the highest form promotion of scientific progress of the entire planet.
Now, I really don't like to do this, but I think we have to bring it up just in the interest of fairness. You're running against a Republican who claims he's been defending NASA, and yet he's gone along with every one of Obama's cuts. In fact, he's apologized for them. He said they have to be done. He wants more cuts. Just tell us very briefly let me say one other thing. Without Republicans like Pete Olson, Obama would have been removed a long time ago. The Republican Party has played a horrible game, the same stupid game the Democratic Party and cowardly game the Democratic Party played with Bush and Cheney. So in 10 words or less, no, just kidding about that, but what do you want to get across to people about characters like this little man, Pete Olson?
Well, that's pretty simple. Pete Olson continues to defend and protect Obama in every step of the way. But I can tell you, as an example, some of our representatives here, some of my volunteers on the campaign, actually went to a meeting that Pete Olson was invited to speak at, and the thing that he said was exactly what Nancy Pelosi said around the impeachment of Bush and Cheney. He said that, quote, we don't have time to focus on impeachment because we have more pressing things to think about. And
you're like wrecking the country.
Yeah. Exactly. But, I mean, this is people going along. Basically, what the Republicans and what Pete Olson is saying is, hey, we're just going to wait for the election because we're more concerned about getting our candidate in than addressing the fact that the country's being wrecked right now and we have to do something about it now. And Olson has, you know, as a mentee, protege to Phil Gramm, who shut down Glass-Steagall, and, you know, as continuing to support the policies of free trade and defend, as he said, my job is to defend Wall Street. That's all I have to say. That's what you're dealing with. That's not a representative of the people. That's not a representative of the nation. That is a puppet, and we have too many of those in Congress and in our institutions of government.
Well, Keisha, sometime before the election, I'll have you on the LaRue Show for the full hour so you can draw the distinctions between yourself and Olson. And really, you're not running so much against Pete Olson as you are running on a platform for the nation, a presidential platform. Rachel, let me come back.
Which he doesn't have, which is a platform for recovery. So, yeah.
Right. Now, Rachel, I want to go to two other issues that have been prominent in your role as a developing leader in Massachusetts. One, I don't really want to talk about other than just to identify. You first came to national attention when you confronted Barney Frank on his support for Obama's fascist health care policy. And Barney did a geek act that to this day he thinks is one of his proudest moments, when what it shows him was as a sputtering fool. But the other issue that you brought to life in the campaign against Barney Frank in 2010 was Glass-Steagall. And at the time, Frank was working on the Dodd-Frank bill, which was specifically designed to prevent Glass-Steagall. And now, under Dodd-Frank, we've seen that all the corruption and crimes and fraud that went on leading up to the blowout in 2007-2008 are continuing because Dodd-Frank changed nothing. So Glass-Steagall has become the most important issue in terms of how to deal with the banking crisis and the financial crisis. What can you tell us about the response on this in Massachusetts? Have people learned this yet? Are they still not getting it? How has that gone?
They're starting to. Pretty much, you know, most people know what it is now. Democrats support it. You know, at the Democratic convention, we organized for a resolution there, and people were overwhelmingly for it. I don't know if they fully understand the relationship between Glass-Steagall and hyperinflation. They agree with it because they get the principle of investment banks should be separate from commercial banks. This was part of the crisis. But I don't think people do really understand the danger of hyperinflation right now and how Glass-Steagall is the only tool to stop that. So, I think we just still have to keep pushing on that issue. We could get Glass-Steagall passed at any time. There's obviously an overwhelming support for it internationally. You know, they're having fights about it in the British Parliament, you know, everywhere. But there's huge support for it, but I think we still have to push people on it now because it's tied up directly with the war drive and the question of hyperinflation.
Well, also to bring this back to Obama, it's clear Obama allowed the corruption to continue, most importantly, through the role of Geithner and Holder, giving a green light to fraudulent policies such as the LIBOR rigging, allowing Goldman Sachs to rip off their own clients without prosecution, and so on. Now, you intervened, you went into the State House in Massachusetts, where apparently there's some legal measures being taken against LIBOR. Mm-hmm. Do people get the treacherous role that Geithner's played and Obama's played on this, or do they still think it's somehow Wall Street acting on its own?
I think they do, when you point it out. I think they do recognize the system as a whole is pretty darn corrupt, and Geithner did know about it. I think they do. I thought people saw the interaction between Bill and the Detroit City Council. That was a very clear example when this city councilwoman, after Bill brought up what LIBOR had been doing.
Bill Roberts you're talking about, yes. Now from the LaRouche slate.
Right. Right, when Bill Roberts was bringing up the fact that, you know, cities had, you know, millions of dollars stolen through the LIBOR scandal, and this woman stood up, the city councilwoman, after he spoke, and said, "I agree with what that last speaker said. These banks, they got their losses bailed out, but I'm sitting here, and we didn't get bailed out after we lost money because of what they did." If you make that point that there's murder that's occurred in the cities and states as a result of what the banks did through LIBOR, and the fact that Geithner did know about it the whole time and he's still doing nothing, we got no disagreement on that in the Massachusetts State House. And after we went in there with that message, a Massachusetts congressman stood up on the floor of Congress and made that same point that lives have been lost because of what LIBOR has done. And yes, there is an ongoing investigation here as well in Massachusetts on it. So I think there's definitely anger over it.
You know, with all the scandals coming out in banking, it seems to me, Keisha, that one of the ways of getting Obama out would be that at any point these scandals could point the way to the White House working with Geithner and Holder to stop prosecutions. Again, I assume you're bringing this up with people.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we need, the courage of a PCORA to actually stand out and say that these people who have violated the Constitution, Obama, his banking cartels around him, the Fast and Furious, or the bailout policy, that all of these things, LIBOR, someone needs to be prosecuted. People need to go to jail for this. And I think a lot of people have cried out for justice to take place. Just a matter of whether or not we're going to have that PCORA or that person with the courage to actually fight this thing to emerge. But that's not gonna, that's gonna lead, and it already has, directly back to Obama. And the question comes down to, once again, whether or not people are going to have the courage, as in the next week at this Democratic Party convention, as the labor official from North Carolina and the few brave souls who stood out and told the truth to say, we cannot afford any more bailouts. We will not continue to elude the American people. LIBOR was a scam. Why is it now out of the media? Why is it not even being discussed anymore? Why is Geithner still running around loose when he should be detained somewhere? So, yeah, I think that is what the message that I'm getting across to people, that they have to have the guts to actually stand up and fight. And standing up and fight means actually knowing what you're fighting for, and that gets back to the fight that we're waging around our three-point platform solution for Glass-Steagall, to end these speculative bailouts, and actually put forth Franklin Roosevelt's policy of a banking separation, which is being called for across the country, the credit system to restore our nation's credit. And then we can actually talk about how we're going to actually rebuild our nation again. And the WAPA is the starting point for that. Yeah.
Keisha, one of the things on this question of leadership and courage is that it really shouldn't take so much courage to say what's true. I mean, Helga Zepp LaRouche made the point that when someone says, well, yeah, Obama's bad, but I don't know, maybe I really can't do anything, you have to say to them, well, then are you willing to risk your life in thermonuclear war, because that's where this thing is going? I mean, that, to a certain extent, the fact that it takes courage for someone to speak the truth shows what Mr. LaRouche is talking about when he talks about the degeneration of a population as well as the degeneration of the leaders of the population.
yeah, that people don't actually know how to come to understand the truth, and therefore speaking the truth requires you to actually go against what is so-called popular opinion. Now, why are those things that are usually corrupt tend to be popular opinion? Well, I mean, very simply, it goes to the paradigm and the culture that was created after, you know, the assassination of President Kennedy. But I think it goes back a little bit further than that. I mean, we should probably say back to President Franklin Roosevelt, that, you know, and even before that, where you have had a culture that doesn't actually understand how to tell the truth, because they've been bombarded by media and by those things that say, oh, you know, just be moderate, like this one guy was telling me today. You know, you have such good ideas, but you just you destroy it for yourself because you won't compromise. And that's what the population has been trained to do, is to compromise.
Well, one of the things that we've been doing in the Boston campaign is to bring in classical culture. And the whole point in classical culture is you have to get people to recognize the higher qualities of man, that we're not really just beasts that shake at a beat, or that we're rubbing up against something that feels pleasurable, but that there are these higher faculties of man. And Rachel, you just had a concert. How did that go? What did you get? I mean, why? This is a question people have. Why does LaRouche bring music into the campaign? Why don't you answer that for people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't have classical music coherent with Obama. I mean, although, you know, Hitler tried to use classical music as part of his campaign, it didn't quite work. Like, there is a certain human, a certain question of how the mind operates, which is inherent in classical music, which is therefore an obstacle to a dictatorship. And so when you have people, and this happens when we're singing on the streets too, which we do quite a lot, that there is a certain irony produced inherently in the mind of the listener, how this beauty can be coherent with an insane, you know, political direction for this country. That there is something truthful in this music, which shows that the universe is a lawful, you know, good universe, because this music is possible. And then, therefore, you know, why are we accepting this ugliness, which is being put out, you know, by these political leaders of both parties, but, you know, especially Obama? So it gives people a sense of what, you know, what they can fight for, that there is something much bigger that is human than they're seeing right now. And that gives them the you know, the strength to fight, to know what they have to fight for.
Well, and this also gets at the same question in science, because you are looking to give people a sense of universal principles that exist outside of the senses. And even though music, in a way, it's a sense perception you're hearing, but it's not beats on your eardrum. There's actually something else in the mind which is activated by music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you see when you see people come to meetings and they hear singing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It definitely gets out of the regular media oriented, you know, type of thinking, which throws a bunch of facts at you and expects you not to read between the lines, because it is inherently a question of what is behind, you know, between the notes and behind the lines, and the principles causing what you see. That's the type of mental experience you're having. So you just, even if you may not be conscious of it, it's a higher qualitative way of thinking than Americans are expected to think right now.
And Keisha, I know you're having a concert sometime soon. You know, we got Rachel's email address out, rachelforcongress.com. Why don't you get out your email address and tell us a little bit about the events you have coming up?
Sure. My website address is keishaforcongress.com, and K-E-S-H-A for congress.com. Yes, I am having a concert on the 30th of September, and you can find the information for that concert on my website there. It's going to be in Sugar Land, Texas, so if anyone listening lives in Sugar Land, then you should come out and join us. And the concert is, it's interesting because we're here in Texas, and our role is to really fight to inspire a cultural change in the population overall, with what Rachel's doing there in Massachusetts, in Texas, and all over the country, because what the beauty of what we're going to be expressing during this concert is exactly what you all have just said, is that we have to get the population to break from, you know, their sense-perceptual views of thinking, and actually recognize what is actual beauty is, when a lot of that is missing from our culture right now. So on the 30th, it's going to be a lot of fun. We are actually going to be doing pieces from Verdi, Bach, and Mozart, and also some Negro spirituals.
And again, they can go to KeishaForCongress.com. Now, yes, we have a little less than 10 minutes, actually about 9 minutes left. And you know, I'd like you both to answer this question. Keisha, you first, because I want to give Rachel a chance at the end to finish the show. But both of you as candidates are under different kinds of, or a lot of pressures. On the one hand, to play by the rules, to approach these as local campaigns, to not be extreme, not be too big, keep it simple, stupid, you know, the normal stuff you get from these consultants who charge you lots of money to basically help you keep the population stupid enough to vote for you. Now, the LaRouche slate has a different conception, that you're actually putting forward a leadership program for the nation as though you were running for president. How do you deal with this pressure from people you talk to who want you to be little so they can fit you into their idea of what they can support? How do you deal with that pressure, Keisha?
Well, I just was actually, you know, once again inspired by the reading of Cotton Mather's Essays to Do Good, and simply stated, you don't actually act on principle and act with courage and do that which is good because you think you're going to get rewarded for it because it's popular. You do it because it's necessary and because it's right. And, you know, you may be doing things that go outside of popular opinion or could get you in a lot of trouble per se. But that's, I mean, I think it really just, to keep it short here, is an expression of what I've committed myself to and what I can say, you know, probably Rachel and Slate, you know, the commitment to transforming the culture and the population in which we live. And so that gives you, with the classical music that we work on every day, with the ideas and science, in actually organizing ourselves around what is a real classical culture. How do you organize the population to be inspired by that? You know, this is what Mr. LaRouche has been talking about recently, that it's our job to go out and inspire a population. And I think that that's absolutely true, because they don't find inspiration in, you know, having a president that's pushing policies of thermonuclear war and it's killing the population. Don't find inspiration in, you know, not actually having adequate food production or actually having a record unemployment rating. But you do find inspiration in a platform for recovery, for victory, that's an expression of what our nation and the principles of our nation actually were founded on.
Well, and Keisha,
that's what gives me the commitment to fight.
Well, it's also, you've proven what Mr. LaRouche has said, which is being pragmatic is stupid, because you ran an unpragmatic campaign, not once, but twice, where you were up against the Democratic Party locally, nationally, up against popular opinion, an African-American woman running for the impeachment of Obama, and yet you won. And so it actually does, it should inspire people to realize that being pragmatic is stupid, but also fighting for principle under conditions of crisis is the right thing to do. So, Keisha, I think it's important for people, again, go to your website, become part of our campaign. Even if you live in West Overshoe, Idaho, you can contribute to Keisha's campaign and help her out. Now, Rachel, Rachel, you've got your election this coming Thursday. You've had to fight against the people who have told you, you know, if you went along with the president or you didn't attack the president, it would help you. How do you handle that? How do you respond to that?
I think that's usually the surface level reaction people have, where they usually the first thing someone says to you is not what they really think. It's what they think they're supposed to say. So a lot of times, if you just keep developing what, you know, the reality is, what the concept is, how Obama is driving for war right now. You know, they might not know every aspect of it. They might not have thought about how bad the drones are, you know, or how, you know, which they should think about, the fact of why they're not more offended, you know, why they're not more moved by the by what they know of what Obama's done so far. But anyway, but just giving people the sense that this really is that bad and continuing to develop it for them, they usually end up agreeing with you and admitting that it is a question of popular opinion, and oftentimes being moved by the fact that you are willing to stick with it and fight for it. So the question of thermonuclear war really does flank any other, you know, type of thinking. And that I've found that when you go strongly with that, strongly with the truth that Obama is a dictator, he is a mass killer, he hasn't responded to any crisis in our country, he hasn't responded to crises in Haiti, you know, our nations are burning down, we have a food crisis, and meanwhile he's pushing for a World War III scenario which could go thermonuclear. When you say these things to people, but confidently and with the passion that you are going to do something about it, they usually end up, you know, wanting to help in some way, or at least, you know, many people do want to support you in that way, and they admit that they agree. So it is a question of creating a new environment by having the courage to tell the truth.
And it's better to face your fears, isn't it, than running away from them?
Most definitely, especially when you have a nut like Obama in there. We can't let him run the show.
I say that because I know, Rachel, that you stood before one of the biggest bullies in the Congress, Barney Frank, and cut him up and down and sideways just by being calm and relaxed. But I know that inside you were fighting this sense of having to speak for something bigger than you.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps. That's what Keisha was talking about also.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, it's rachelforcongress.com. The election is this Thursday. And if you don't live in the district, be creative. Figure out a way how to help Rachel. But more importantly, look, it's not about elections. It's been wonderful having a chance to talk with Keisha and Rachel on this program. But we're talking about saving the nation. And starting Monday, Barack Obama is going to begin his re-coronation in Charlotte, North Carolina. There's still a chance to derail that. The examples we gave at the beginning of the program and the examples of these two young women of having the courage to stand up and tell the truth, that's what's needed. We need handfuls of people with the courage to speak boldly and tell the truth. And people out there listening, that's your job too. Don't just support Keisha and Rachel by saying, good work, girls, I like what you're doing, keep up the good work. You've got to take responsibility as well. Go to the website, LaRouchePack.com, go to KeishaForCongress.com and RachelForCongress.com, and do your job. It's time for the people of this country to stop being stupid and pragmatic and fight for the principles of our nation. So, Keisha and Rachel, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this has been the LaRouche Show for September 1st, 2012. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.